in this real form. Did you get any experience of what became apartheid when you were in South Africa? Did you
notice yes, it was very noticeable. Oh, yes, seats marked. Natives had to sit at the back of the bus. Oh, yeah. And rather funny, when we were on this farm, I think this was the first visit. We did several visits there later on in my life. We're in there one day, and this other farmer came in, and this farmer we were staying with, he used to take us round and visit all these different farms, you know. Anyway, this fella came to visit him, and he said, no other wonder we've got trouble here. So this farmer we were staying with said, well, what's the trouble? He says, well, I've been to the hospital there, and he says, they brought a native in there with a broken arm. And he says, what I've seen there, he says, is disgusting, it's disgraceful. He says, they set this man's arm without any anaesthetic. Now, he says, we are just making a stick for our own backs here. He says, that man, when he goes out, he'll tell the story. And he says, you're making unrest. And how true it turned out later on in years. But that's what was going on. There was this distinct.
How did you feel about that at that time?
Weren't happy about it, no? Because we treat them here, particularly South Shields. I've always been very friendly with them, particularly Arabs, because an Arab always works for the same rate of pay as a white. If a white fireman and a white Arab, they get the same rate of pay. Not so Indian, Pakistani, they'll work for less. That's why the Arab's more respected, I suppose. Anyway, that's another side of the story. So what now?
Look, the journey on the ship itself was a comfortable one. I think you said you were in...
Oh, yes. Well, when we left, we were there a month, then we'll rejoin the ship. But before we left the ship, all these people that had taken us in invited us to a final dinner at this restaurant. I forget the name of it, in Durban. And we all went there, and they thanked us, and we thanked them for the hospitality. Then we left the next day and sailed. Then on the way up, the Indian firemen went on strike, said it was too hot going up into the Red Sea. They'd never done that run before. It's not a run, you see. They only did South Africa and back. Now they're going up in the Red Sea. But we'd picked up a lot of Egyptian firemen who'd been on a ship that had been torpedoed. So they volunteered to fire the ship. So they went down below and fired the ship through up to Alexandria. And later on, I met one of these firemen. I was wandering around the streets with this friend of mine. And we met this fella, and he was all over, you know, come to my place. So I went to his house, and he gave us some tea and sweet cakes. And there were sweet tea on me. But, funny. They entertained us a lot, these Egyptians. They used to play a game. They used to blindfold themselves. And one man had a bell. And he used to crawl around with this ring, this bell, and they had to try and catch him, you know, with a hearing. Because they couldn't see in their blindfolded. Get some antics for that lot.
The journey up the Red Sea would be pretty hot.
It was hot, yeah. I think it was the worst time of the year, heat-wise.
And did that cause any problems for you?
Not for me. I've always been a hothouse plant, really. Heat doesn't bother me. Cold does. In fact, when I was picked up out the water, Mediterranean, it was April, the sea temperature, I don't know what it was, it wouldn't be cold, but I couldn't move a limb or an arm, I was just frozen, I had to be lifted, couldn't move.
Did you sail straight through, did you call it Aden?
No, straight through.
And you went to where?
Alexandria, yes.
And what happened to you then?
From there we went to the fleet repair ship, the Resource. Now a funny thing happened here. When we were down at Durban earlier, another ERA in the company, he was staying in the town. Anyway, he came back and he showed us this watch. It was a silver watch, might have been chrome. He says, oh, that's a nice watch. He says, oh yes, a girlfriend bought me this, you know. And I thought, oh, that's unusual. And he passed it around, had a look at it. No, that was all forgotten. And when we got on this fleet repair ship, the Resource, this Bill Mackay, the one that lives at Whitley Bay, he said he had a watch. It was a gold watch. And it had been, I don't know whether it was his 21st birthday present or not. It was a present, a birthday present, gold watch. Oh, that's a nice watch. Then, that was that. I think that was before the silver watch. Not quite sure of the time in here. Anyway, when we're on the fleet repair ship, this watch gets stolen. So he reports it, and they put a notice out, anybody found this watch, blah, blah, blah. And Malcolm, this was the man that showed us the silver watch, was always asking Bill Mackay, have they found your watch yet, Bill? He says, no, never found it. Any rate, was all forgotten. Then I gets drafted from the Resource to the Naiad. Bill Mackay gets drafted to the Carlisle. Now Malcolm, the man that had the silver watch, gets drafted to the Naiad with me. So we're not on the Naiad very long, only a few days, when out he comes with his story about the watch. So it produces a watch. It's now a gold watch. Silver. So I said, look at these, passing it round. You know, he must have forgot that I was there. Gold watch. I said, why, it was silver. A chrome. Suddenly become gold. I thought, Bill Mackay's watch. So I reported to the chief ERA. He says, are you sure? He says, mind, you're making a different, a nasty accusation here, you know. I says, I'm almost certain. He says, right, oh. He says, I'll put the case forward, and I had to go up before the command officer. Told him, I says, that watch belongs to Bill Mackay. It was stolen on the Resource. He says, are you sure? I says, yeah, certain. He says, right, oh. He says, just leave everything. He says, we'll get in touch with the Carlisle and get Bill Mackay to come over and identify it. Don't say anything, leave everything. So everything went on. Two ships eventually came in. Bill Mackay came aboard, took him along to the commander. Is that your watch? Definitely my watch. Right. And they got this Malcolm fella. Where'd you get this watch? Because he had admitted he'd stolen it. So then they opened his locker and they found all kinds of things in there. Even shirts, Stoker's shirts with their names on. Must have been a bit of a kleptomaniac. And rather funny, he was a very wealthy person. His parents were. They owned a motor bodybuilding business in the smallest county in England, Rutland. And funny enough, previous to that, he lost his own wallet on the Naiad, and somebody had found it and handed it in. With everything in. Any rate, the next thing, there's an official thing of me, and he's caught guilty, all assembled on the quarter deck, and he's officially disrated and sent ashore to the Glasshouse. Now, what happened to him after that? He might have missed the Naiad sinking, but he might have caught it up on another ship. On the other hand, he might have survived the war. But that was a little case that cropped up there.
Before we start talking about your work on this repair ship, what were your first impressions of Alexandria?
Well, a rather smelly type of place. They used to hose the streets down every night about midnight. They used to come and hose all the streets down, which was needed, with salt water, you know, from the river, and these big hoses that spray everything down. And the people, there was an awful lot of spies, German spies. That was the trouble which the British found there. The docks, German spies, you know, a communal community. You didn't know who was who. And it was very difficult. And everybody seemed to be shifty trying to rob you. You know, you get little boys squirting mud and shit and stuff on your shoes, and another little mob around the corner coming to clean it for a couple of hackers, you know. All crafty. Never trust a gypo, you know. That used to be the thing then. Nobody liked them. But it was on account of that treachery. They used to say, never get in a cab or a galley if there's another man sitting with a driver, because you'll get done and knifed, you know, and that was going on. People were getting knifed. robbed.
But so the camp would be crowded with troops as well.
Oh, yes. There was Army, Navy, Air Force, the whole lot.
The night life must have been pretty varied and active.
Well, there was plenty of it. If you had the money, there was the Petit Trianon and the Grand Trianon. Wonderful floor shows on, you know, but you had to have the money. The Fleet Club was a popular attraction. It was quite a big place. They ran a bingo, which they call, what they call it in those days?
Housey.
It had another name. And it was very busy. And if you're on shore, you could get a crash down. That was a mattress on the floor there for, I think, was about a shilling equivalent money. Of course, the hotels were fairly dear, but you could get these crash downs. They were always packed on a night. And in this Fleet Club, you sometimes got, there was a film in there, film or cinema, and it'd flash on, all crew, Nyad, report immediately. You got reports to get back to ship that was sailing and all.
Ladies and the prostitution, was that pretty right?
Yes, that was rampant, yes. But it was all controlled. There was medical orderlies in all these places. There was a separate one for officers, which actually was bombed. Some officers would be killed in there. So there you are, killed on the job. I don't know what happened. But there were, because was it Lady Astor found out about this and wanted everything shut out?
Were you warned about this? I mean,
oh, yes, you were strictly warned, told about it, to take, you know, condoms and that, pick them up before you go ashore and all that. Oh, yes, they're very strict.
And yet VD must have been pretty...
Yes, they got it. We got cases of it, not a lot, because they had a sick bay on the CDA, Contagious Diseases Act, I think the room was known as, and they were in there. But there wasn't many.
Were there any trouble ashore between sailors, soldiers and airmen?
Not to my knowledge, no. The only trouble I found ashore was in America, which comes on later.
Yes, we'll pick that up later. You yourself, what activities did you, you know, leisure activities did you find ashore to keep you occupied?
Well, actually, I didn't go ashore a lot. I was a bit more reserved in those days and more or less stopped aboard. But when we went ashore, we did the zoo. And one day, when we went to the zoo, this particular deer was shut. No, looking through the gate, and this bloke inside, another type, come up and said, "Do you want to be in?" Says I. So he says, "It'll cost you so many acres, you know." So we got in. We got a private tour, like. And he opened the gate and let us in and went round. And he says, "Do you want any souvenirs?" And he went into this porcupine's den and bashed the porcupine with a stick and got some prongs off it and gave us one. And took us round the elephant and got the elephant to stand up. And got a private tour. But that's how corrupt everything was, really. With money, you can get in anywhere. But other than that, and occasional runs ashore at the Fleet Club, I didn't play the bingo. I thought if I'd won, I'd never have the courage to go up and collect the money.
This was you sailed originally from England in December 1940, I think you said, around about that time. So it must be into spring of 1941 that you were in Alexandria.
Yes.
Now the war, you know, in the desert was fluctuating.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you know what was going on?
Oh yes. Well, we had radio, we used to listen to the radio regular. You know, we're getting the broadcasts from the UK. That was all. We didn't get much local knowledge. Bar the runs to Tobruk, would get to know there was another destroyer gone. That was another point that happened. See, the Navy was requiring engine room activities qualified with watchkeeping. There's a watchkeeping certificate. But a lot of ERAs were crafty and they weren't going forward to get this certificate. Because once you got that certificate, you were drafted onto the boats, which was the destroyers, which were doing the Tobruk run, and they were getting fairly heavy losses. I said, "Well, you're not going in for that lot," they say. So they started drafting them through automatically, whether you had it or not. Things got bad, so you were liable to get pushed onto that. But that was another thing. There was a lot of Polish fighters up there, and we used to carry some of them on the deck. At any rate, one of the fellows said, "Oh, can you get me a souvenir?" to one of these Polish chaps he'd been talking to. And I think they only did a short spell up there, a month in Tobruk, and they were brought back.
Were these military people? Army, Polish army.
Anyway, sure enough, he picked this fella up, and he brought him a ring back, but it had the fella's finger as well. He just chopped it, and it was still on the finger. They were pretty ruthless types, these Poles, apparently, particularly with Germans. I don't think they were very popular.
Did you meet men of what became the Eighth Army who had been in the fighting?
Oh, yes. You met them with Shaw and Alex, and they sometimes come through with that. Yeah. But mainly you're kept in your own groups, you know, Army, Army, and Navy, Navy.
Now, the vessel that you said that you were on, this repair vessel, I think you said?
Yeah.
What were you doing on that?
Well, we were on shift work, and I was on night shift mainly, and I was making a gun sight for an Oerlikon gun. We did all repairs, you know, for destroyers used to come alongside for repairs and that. But that's a job I got, and I never got it finished because I was drafted out. If I got it finished, somebody else would finish it off.
And where were you accommodated?
On the resource. And we were getting air raids then. And my duty on one particular night was to man the big salvage pump. The salvage pump was on the jetty, big thing, which was, if the ship was sinking, you could rig this up, pump water out the ship. Well, it had been dismantled for overhaul. So my duty was the fire pump. So I said to the duty officer, I said, "Well, the fire pump's in bits. I cannot do anything with it. What's the point?" He says, "Your duty is down there, fire pump." So I went down to fire pump, and it was a pretty heavy raid. The bomb started falling. So I took shelter in one of the go-downs. And the bombs, no, it was more the gunfire from the resource. She had 4.7s on the deck. Why, the blast was coming down, hitting the quay, which is dry, you know, dust everywhere. I was being blown from one end of the shed to the other end, all in this dust, all for no point, you know, because you couldn't start the pump. But that was the orders. That's your job. You go down and man that pump. It took me a month to put it together, if the bits were there. And another thing happened during that, there was another raid. I don't know whether this was a night raid. There was another raid during the day, and it shows how they twist things for publicity angles. There's an air raid, and there's a fleet repair ship here, 100 yards broadside onto it, anchored off, is the fleet repair ship, the hospital ship, Main. Right. So the Germans are bombing, they're trying to hit the resource, probably, trying to hit anything. Anyway, what do? They take a photograph showing the Main in the background and the bomb burst in between. Then it appears in the London Pictorial, dastardly attack on British hospital ship. Now, if they'd taken it from the Main, showing the resource, would have been good attack on fleet repair ship. You see, this is how they twist things around. And shortly after that, I joined this ship, the Valiant, which had been sunk in harbour. You know about that, don't you? The Queen Elizabeth and the Valiant. The Valiant was sunk. Italian, what do you call them?
It's more submarine there.
Aye. They came in, planted bombs, time bombs, sticker bombs, underneath the Valiant. And one or two underneath a tanker. I forget the name of the tanker. Master plan. If this had worked, dear me, been disastrous. Didn't work, did it? Right. So, the thing's set. And one of the sentries on the Valiant noticed a man sitting on a buoy. So he reports this. And pick him up, bring him aboard. Italian. Get him to talk. What you doing there? Blah, blah, blah. And in the end, he must have had it worked out, timing. He says, "This ship's going to blow up in a minute." See? Well, they issued round. Sure enough, one bomb went off. Bang. Another bomb went off. But the bomb under the magazine never went off. Fate. Right? So the ship sunk. Right? Now the tanker, this was the master plan. The tanker was supposed to blow up first, flood the harbour with petrol, and there's the whole fleet, Eastern Fleet, bottled up in there. The whole harbour's ablaze. The whole fleet could have went a journey. The bomb under the tanks never went off. The one on the engine room did, so she sank stern first. Everything went wrong. The Valiant sank. There was no loss of life. They got everybody on the deck. Just went down. Now, about 2 days after, there's a state visit by some big nabob from India visiting the fleet. Now, this photograph's in the London Illustrated, and if anybody has a look at this, they'll see the ship sunk. It's only about a foot out the water. And here it shows a state visit of the so-and-so of India aboard the HMS Valiant. And the thing sunk. But that's how things are covered up. So eventually they get the thing up. And I say, after we were sunk on the Naiad, goes into this transit camp, and I was transferred to the Valiant to steamer down to Durban. And from Durban she went over the States. Well, I left her in Durban and came home and went into Land and Craft.
So how long were you on this repair ship?
I think no more than 3 weeks. Not long.
And you then you said you were posted to the Naiad.
That's right.
How was that done? Was it on a board or a letter? Or
no, verbally. Verbally, as far as I can't remember any notice being up.
And you joined that crew as what? What were you?
Acting fourth class artificer. But I didn't have a watch keeping certificate. Once you got your watch keeping certificate, you were fourth class. Acting, you weren't. But you had, you see, the idea of this always irritates seamen and stokers. ERAs go in either as leading hands if they're under 21 or POs direct, where a stoker or a seaman's got to work up through the ranks. We go in automatic, and there's always this, why should there be preferential treatment? But that's the way the system works. And the idea is, the ERA is in charge. So when you're in the boiler room, you can override the PO stoker. You're the senior. And I think that's one of the reasons, so you've got some control, otherwise you cannot control anything, can you? You've got no authority.
What date would this be when you joined the Naiad?
Yeah. No idea. Some people kept diaries, which was unofficial. Well, I never saw anybody keep one, but as earlier records of, later records have proved, some did, because I've got some very accurate reports of different things. I really can't remember.
It must have been round about the summertime of 1941.
It must have been, yeah.
Working on, you know, what we've talked about in the past.
I think I was aboard Naiad about 18 months. She was sunk in 1942, and we was to join her about 41.
Anyway, you had to join her. You're on the ship. You went to join her. Can you describe the ship? What was she? The size and.
Well, it was a Dido class cruiser. She was the flagship of the squadron, the 15th Cruiser Squadron. About 5,000 ton. She had five turrets, 5.25 dual purpose, high and low angle, which were a new gun at that particular time. Multiple pom poms. Oligans. I don't know the exact number of oligans. Torpedo tubes, which were never used. They were a bit of a menace, because normally you've got to swing them outboard, and if there's aircraft, a bomb splinter hitting the head of a up-close ship, they were always inboard. They were never used. Never had reason to use them on that particular ship, anyway. Speed about 33 knots, which was fast.
When had she been built?
She was only about 2 years old as a date on. That's on there. Oh! I don't know where the date's on. 1940 to 42. She's only 2 years old when she went the journey. Oh, I'm standing up with this on.
How many crew?
about 550. There was 87 lost.
Who was captain of the vessel when you joined it?
A Captain Kelsey.
What was he like?
Very good. Now, the new man that took over, Grantham, Guy Grantham, I wasn't keen on him, and I don't think anybody else was. Later on, we'll talk about this.
But Kelsey, you say, it was a
Kelsey,
good
guy. Kelsey, he was a nice man. You know, he would speak to you, he was comrade-y, and he told you more. He was very with you, you know.
Any other officers on board the ship when you joined that you remember, that you recall?
Well, the Commander E, who would go into the detail later, he was an elderly fella. He's senior to the senior engineer. He's the man in charge. And he used to give pep talks, you know, because under bombing attacks, the crew were getting bomb happy. Some were breaking down, going ashore, mentally deranged, really. The continuous attacks. And he used to give these pep talks occasionally. And he used to say, and this was proved, he says, there's nobody aboard here more frightened than what I am. And he says, don't get away with anything else than that. Nobody. Now, this used to be proved in the engine room. And it was very nerve-destroying to other people in there. If you got a near miss, water would come pouring down the vents, you know, with the bombs. Blast. He used to shoot along, dash up, bang easy, because you're fastened in, you can't get out then, you know, you're sailed down in action. And he walked back down, you know, then bang, another one. This was going on, you know. Couldn't prevent it. He was...
What was his name?
I don't remember his name. But a nice man. Lovely man. But just gone. This crops up later on, which it can happen, but I don't think it did happen, but there you are, that's it.
But number two to the captain, do you recall him?
No, I don't. Jimmy the Warren, first lieutenant, he's known as Jimmy the Warren. I can't recall him.
Any of the engineering room staff with yourself that you recall being with?
Yes, on the engineering side, officers, the two most troublesome and awkward ones were the warrant engineers. Now, these are men that's come up through the ranks. They know all the tricks. They've done them themselves, you see. One in particular, Green. Now, this incident happened to me. We're on watch, coming to port. And the order comes through, shut down number one boiler feed pump. Shuts it down. Now he's coming down in the boiler room. And he sees me shutting the pump down. And he rushes over to me, pushes me up against the front of the boiler furnace, and says, you are the bugger that's smashing these pumps. And he goes to the pump in question to shut the stop valve. Before you shut a pump down, you shut the stop valve. He goes to this pump to shut the stop valve. It's shut. Nearly breaks his wrist. And he looks round and he walks away. Right? Now, there's a chief stoker down there, a stoker PO, and three stokers. And nobody liked him. They said, right, we've got our chance. We can get rid of him now. We are all witnesses. He assaulted you. He pushed you against that boiler. He was in the wrong. The valve was shut. He hasn't apologised. He's went away. Now, I thought, they keep getting on to me about this. Get them, we'll back you up. But sometimes they don't. But nevertheless, I give a thought. I says, aye, he's an officer. The one that'll get transferred will be me. And I'm happy in this ship. I'm not going to risk that. So I left it. So the story continues. Jack Langhorne, another ERA, he was friendly with his Green. So a month or two had passed, and it must have been on Green's mind, because he told Jack Langhorne, he says, you know, a while back, I went down that boiler room, and I was nicknamed Smokey Joe, on account of smoke through him, making smoke at the funnels. any rate, he says, smoke is you. I rushed up, pushed him out the road. I thought he hadn't stopped the pump properly, but he had. He says, will you apologise to him? That's Langhorne. And Langhorne came to me. He says, Jimmy Green says he's very sorry for what he did when he pushed you off that pump. He was in the wrong. Now, that's the type of man he was.